Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It may come as no surprise to you, but many Americans don't see eye to eye with scientists. Whether it's GMOs or pesticides, climate change, nuclear power, evolution, vaccines, animal testing, Americans as a whole are a lot more skeptical of those ideas than the scientists who actually do the gene splicing, the climate modeling, or the clinical trials. Those are the findings of a new survey by the Pew Research Center and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Why the disconnect? Is it a communication breakdown? Or are these issues contentious enough that folks are just going to have to agree to disagree? What do you think? Do you accept most things, most scientific findings, but not all? Is there one issue that you just don't agree on? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or on Twitter, you can tweet us at SciFry. Lee Rainey is Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center in Washington. He's a co-author of the new report. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Lee, how do you explain the disconnect?
Well, there are a variety of explanations, and that's part of the surprise of this story. We asked about 13 different issues, and there seem to be different dynamics affecting each of these issues, even as the public tells us that they appreciate scientists, they like scientists' work, and they support government funding for science. So let me run down a couple of the big findings. You mentioned genetically modified food. There's a 51-point gap between scientists who support the safety of eating that food and adults who don't necessarily think it's safe to eat that food. There's a 42-point gap between scientists who favor the use of animals in research and citizens who support that same idea. Pesticides and foods, a 40-point gap. On climate change, a 37-point gap. But in each of these cases, something special seems to be going. Sometimes it's trust. Sometimes it may be political views. Sometimes it might be driven by demographic differences.
But on the other hand, you just said also that people like science and they do trust scientists.
They do feel good about the place of science in American society. 79% say science has made life better in this country, and they are particularly appreciative of the way that science has contributed to environmental quality, food safety, and things like that. And they support government funding for science. That was one of the surprising things, that there was big across-the-board support for government funding, both of basic research as well as technical and applied research.
Mm-hmm. Some respondents actually said that science has made life more difficult for people. How is that?
It might be a reflection of economic hard times. People who are struggling, and maybe they are worried about their job status in relation to technology or globalization or things like that. There might be other people who live in communities that are stressed out in one way or another. So it's not a universal opinion, but it's clearly the case that the vast majority of Americans hold science in high esteem and scientists in high esteem. But when it gets down to these specific issues, there are a lot of differences.
I thought it was interesting that even among scientists, 10% still don't think GMOs are safe to eat. A similar proportion don't think childhood vaccines should be required. So there are some holdouts even in the scientific community.
Yeah, it was an interesting sample to gather together. We worked with the American Association for the Advancement of Science to use their membership list, particularly those scientists who are connected to the United States. But the broad story here is that there is scientific consensus on the big, big issues, like the safety of genetically modified foods, certainly about evolution, certainly about the human role in climate change.
Mm-hmm. Is there something that particularly surprised you at all, or does this is this very much in line with past surveys?
Well, it's new to us in some respects. We've added a great new number of issues to the kind of polling that we've done on these subjects in the past. So it was surprising just to see that there were gaps across a variety of issues that didn't necessarily sometimes have a lot of political dimension to them or necessarily have a lot of high policy salience at least in the current environment. But the one that was striking to me is we asked about world population growth and would it be a major problem for our food and resources, or whether we would eventually find a way to stretch our resources. And actually, scientists were a little bit more glum than the general public. 82% of the AAAS scientists said that population growth would be a strain on resources, and that's compared with only 59% of the public who thought that. The public was more confident than scientists would solve the problem.
Is there any way to find out how politicians measure up between scientists and the public?
We didn't actually look at political differences, or at least politicians' differences. We did look at people's individual ideologies and partisan inclinations, and some of the story is pretty familiar there. The Republicans and Democrats sometimes see the world in different ways, but that's not a consistent story across these issues. Sometimes the ideology and partisanship doesn't play a role much at all.
Mm-hmm. Anything that you might add about the coming presidential campaign, about what this survey bodes for?
Well, I think the scientific community is quite anxious about its future, and so they, in some respects, will be looking very carefully at the candidates' positions on the role of science in our broader culture, whether they support funding, what kinds of funding resources they are supportive of. In other words, some scientists are a little bit anxious that political actors have too much influence on funding choices and things like that.
Mm-hmm. One of the classic battles, of course, has always been between science and religion. But I'd like to bring on another guest who says we're beyond that stage. Americans today, he says, have moved on beyond that black and white way of seeing things. They've moved to an almost buffet-style approach to science. Tim O'Brien is assistant professor of sociology at the University of Evansville in Indiana. He has a new survey out in American Sociological Review. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. O'Brien.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Are you saying that the whole science-religion dichotomy is dead?
Well, not entirely. Our research found basically three big groups of Americans, and one group sort of prefers science to religion, and one group sort of prefers religion to science, but we also found this third group that really throws a wrench into the idea that science and religion are incompatible with one another. And this third group of Americans, it's really interesting. They are very well informed about science. They are more or less appreciative of science and technology's practical uses. But when it comes to certain mainstream scientific theories, for example, about evolution and about the Big Bang, this third group of Americans, which we call post-seculars, they tend to disagree with the scientific community.
So they're good with all the other views in science except evolution and the Big Bang.
That's right. And it seems that, for the most part, this group of people is well-educated. They are of fairly high social class. And this is sort of runs counter to what a lot of social scientists assume about attitudes about science and about religion. But we're seeing that this group of Americans, these post-seculars, are pretty well-informed. They know a lot about science. And it's not like they don't know what scientists have to say about religion, or pardon me, about the Big Bang or about evolution. It's just that they choose to disagree with scientists when it comes to a few particular issues.
Mm-hmm. So they'll be very vocal in a couple of issues and just let it pass on the other ones.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's really no conflict between science and religion when it comes to questions about, you know, planetary motion or genetics or experimental design. But when it comes to some of these big questions about the origins of the universe, the origins of human life, what we find is that about a fifth of Americans, about 21% of American adults, tend to side with religion rather than science.
Mm-hmm. Lee, any reaction to this?
It actually is so fascinating because it lines up with other kinds of work that we have done here at the Pew Research Center in our own religion unit. About a fifth of Americans, a very similar number to the 20% Dr. O'Brien has come up with, have described themselves as unaffiliated in their religious affiliation. They are, in many cases, very deep believers and have spiritual lives where they believe in prayer and God and things like that, but they aren't necessarily anxious to be connected to a particular institution. Same thing is going on in politics. We see, particularly in our political polling, that young folks are detaching themselves from official political parties and essentially wanting to cobble together their own political and spiritual belief systems. I love the notion that Dr. O'Brien's team came up with of a buffet. People are essentially sort of mixing and matching a whole host of views in a networked age.
Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a rise in non-believers as opposed to years ago, but there's still that room for the buffet of people to – they feel comfortable picking and choosing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and in some respects, it's just their relationship to formal institutions. They are very comfortable with lots of different beliefs and values in their lives, but it's the mm-hmm. connection to an official organ of the church or even a official political organization that seems to give them pause.
Let me go to Rick in Denver quickly on the phone. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Here in Denver, through the good offices of some folks at the University of Colorado, particularly a professor, John Cohen, they formed what they call Café Scientifique that are modeled on Café Philosophique and from Europe. And it's been going on for years, and we meet regularly at in venues where, you know, there's generally beer served, but then there's a general presentation and then some question and answer by the public. And this is all free. Mm. I'm just thinking that, and I think these are going on not just in Denver, but throughout the country, and I think those are good avenues for lessening this divide between scientists and the general public.
Thanks for the call. Tim, any reaction?
They are going on all over the place,
aren't they?
Right, and one of the things that my co-author, Shiri Noy, and I talk about in the paper is that one of the ways to kind of reduce these gaps between these big groups of Americans might be personal contact. And, you know, it's kind of what the caller is talking about, just the idea that we can surround ourselves with people who have different ideas about science and about religion, who have different beliefs about where, you know, humans came from, how the universe began. I think that close personal contact is an important first step in kind of reducing these divides.
Well, it's good that you bring that up because that's what we're going to be talking about in our next segment, is about how personal contact might be influential, just as you say. Tim O'Brien, thank you. Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Evansville in Indiana. And Lee Rainey, Director of the Internet Science and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center in Washington. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
As I say, after the break, we're going to come back and talk about swaying people's minds about science using personal contact, which is sort of in the playbook from political canvassing. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the disconnect between scientists and the public. I'd like to play a conversation we recorded back in 2008, and it really gets to the heart of some of these ideas we've been talking about. It's a lengthy but valuable exchange between vaccine researcher Paul Offit and our caller Chantal, a mother who told us why she refused to get her kids vaccinated by her doctor. Chantal in Raleigh, hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Basically, I have a quick question for Dr. Offit. He states that all vaccines are safe and given in multi-doses, you know, 5 and 6 shots at a time for a 6-week-old, you know, it's completely fine. But I beg to differ. There's a lot of aluminum in vaccines. A 6-week-old can get up to 1,250 micrograms of aluminum at one time. There has not been any studies been conducted to find out how aluminum can affect a child. On the insides. It has been done at the injection site, but not on the insides. So there has been no studies to find out, is the aluminum rested in the child's brain? Is it, you know, sitting in the child's bones? That's my main concern, and that is the number one concern why I will not follow the CDC's guidelines. I will be a delayed vaccination mother. My child will be vaccinated on my own schedule. I just want to know what his take is on that.
Okay, Paul.
Sure, Chantel. You raise a question, actually, that a number of parents have raised and are concerned about. You know, how about these other components that are in vaccines? And thimerosal is a mercury-containing preservative that was in vaccines. Aluminum is contained in a number of adjuvants, which are ways of sort of enhancing the immune response that are used in a number of vaccines as well. And again, it's, you know, the dose is critical. So, for example, if you look at the amount of aluminum that's contained in vaccines, it's less than is contained in infant formulas and much, much less that are contained, for example, in soy formulas. So I think, you know, you have to put it in perspective. We live on the planet Earth. If we choose to live on the planet Earth, that means that we're going to be exposed to both light metals like aluminum or heavy metals like mercury that are part of the Earth's surface and enter into the water that we drink, and consequently the infant formula that we give our children or the breast milk that we give our children.
Chantal, is there anything that that Dr. Offit could tell you to change your mind?
Absolutely not. There's no concern. I already know that to a certain extent my child is already predisposed to a lot of other things on my husband's side of the family as well as some of mine. There's no way that I would give my child six shots at one time regardless.
So even if his studies are correct, and you admit or go back and research what he's saying to be true.
I do not put any faith into anything that my government tells me. I know that may sound absolutely absurd, but there's no independent studies done.
Do you not believe in the system of testing drugs? Is that what you're saying?
Not when there are no independent studies done.
If you spend 10 minutes talking to any of the people involved at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or frankly pharmaceutical companies who do the research that does the phase 1 and phase 2 and phase 3 safety testing for vaccines, I think you'd feel very confident about the process. I think the fact that you are distant to the process means that you're much more likely to view it with suspicion, but it's an unreasonable suspicion, because what the Food and Drug Administration requires for a vaccine is a very high bar. I mean, I think vaccines are frankly the safest, best tested things we put in our body because of those systems.
So tell me, how many studies, regardless of whether they're independent, done by the CDC or by the pharmaceutical companies, have been done on vaccine loading, which means 5 or 6 vaccines at one time? How many?
I would say in the probably somewhere in the vicinity of the high hundreds to low thousands.
If you look,
for example, at any new vaccine that gets licensed in the United States, you have to do, by definition, by FDA requirement, something called concomitant use studies, which is to say, for example, if a new HPV vaccine comes onto the market or a rotavirus vaccine comes onto the market, you have to show that that vaccine does not interfere with the immune response or the safety of existing vaccines, and similarly, that existing vaccines don't interfere with the safety or immune response of that new vaccine. That has to be done for every new vaccine. So concomitant use studies are the way to answer the question, can children receive all these vaccines at once safely?
Thank you, Chantal. And I can see, you can see why, Paul. You know, I don't think there's anything that you can say to some people who are convinced. You know, her last answer was, I don't believe that. That was an interview we did in 2008 with Paul Offit, who is a well-known vaccine researcher, and with Chantal, a very articulate mother who refused to get her kids vaccinated by CDC regulations. And it's quite obvious there that it makes you wonder if you can say anything to some people to change their minds, present them with the evidence, even when their minds are made up. Can you actually persuade people if you, as Paul said, if you spend 10 minutes with these people, you might be persuaded and they might talk to you? Well, my next guests have actually looked into the idea that you can persuade people by close personal contact with them. They're studying what really makes people and voters change their minds about issues. Michael LaCour is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Political Science and Statistics at UCLA. He's an affiliate of the California Center for Population Research. Welcome to Science Friday, Michael.
Great. Pleased to be here.
Brendan Nyhan is an assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Is that something foreign to you? When you listen to Chantal, have you heard stuff like that before?
Sure. So just to speak a bit about the study that I did and how personal contact works and how that can be extrapolated to the conversation we just listened to, motivating question in my research is it possible, can a single conversation change voters' minds on divisive issues? And so what I did was conducted with Don Green, a professor at Columbia, and the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. I fully randomized, placebo-controlled experiment where I had both gay and straight canvassers going to the door discussing gay equality or placebo recycling message. And then I measured individuals' attitudes with an unrelated survey they took online in the days, weeks, and months following these conversations. And the results are that both straight and gay canvassers changed voters' minds initially, around 6 percentage point increase in the days following these conversations. However, the change only lasted when it was a gay person discussing gay equality. Further, the change spread to others and actually changed others' minds in voter social networks when it was contact with a gay person discussing gay equality.
So it was the personal connection between the gay person who they were trying to show, you know, there in person, and the person you were trying to convince. But that was the key, that it was that person standing there talking to them.
That's right. And it was the combination of, you know, contact with a minority coupled with a discussion of issues pertinent to people's identity. So it's individuals who had a direct personal stake in the issue. In that conversation that we just listened to, you heard the scientist, you know, not really speaking to the mother in language that she could connect with. Mm-hmm. I went out and tried to replicate this experiment on gay equality. I took a group of undergraduate researchers, and I got flat lines across the board, no change. I had them talking about, you know, the changes in public opinion, scientific studies, voters closed the door.
Didn't work. Brendan, you actually tried out this idea in a little different way by attempting to change people's minds about vaccination using a personal story about a baby who gets measles due to other parents not vaccinating their kids. And what kind of results did you have?
Yeah, well, so our results, unfortunately, weren't as encouraging. This, I should say, wasn't delivered interpersonally the way Michael's message was. This was in text form on the computer. It was a message from the Centers for Disease Control that's used to promote vaccination. And so what my co-authors and I wanted to test was, is this kind of storytelling effective? It doesn't have the interpersonal element, but of course, it's much easier to scale messages beyond interpersonal contact, right? So if we give people stories they can relate to, is that more persuasive than just telling people about the dangers of the disease in the kinds of scientific language that some people have trouble engaging with? And unfortunately, what we found is it didn't have any effect. I at least was quite optimistic that this story might be more dramatic and more relatable and have more of an impact than trying to talk about diseases in a more abstract way. But we found actually it had no effect on people's intention to vaccinate a future child.
Mm-hmm. Do any of you suspect that if the fringe, you know, we've seen the studies and the books have been written about the past campaign about friends influence friends. If you know, if your friends do something, you're more apt to do something along the same lines. Are there any studies to show that if your friends vaccinate their kids, or they have a feeling about gay people, that they too might be influenced by that?
There's actually several studies that look at relationships and vaccination status within social networks, including one that my co-authors and I have done. So this seems like it could be a powerful approach. People within communities can be much more effective advocates, I think, for vaccination than people from outside or even public health agencies. And you know, I think it's interesting, I heard that this is a lesson we relearned again in West Africa in fighting Ebola, when it was only when the medical authorities started working through local community leaders that they acquired the trust of local communities and began to spread the kinds of safe burial practices that were needed to contain the epidemic.
Let's go to the phones to Hugh in Oakland, California. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. When our son was younger getting his vaccines, we had some concerns that we had read. It was new information for us, as well as being skeptical about how big corporations are involved in various government processes, lobbying, including the FDA. What helped answer our questions was we simply asked our pediatrician, and rather than giving vague general answers, she gave very specific answers about what was in the vaccines, what wasn't, etc. So it really helped having somebody we trust with medical knowledge, you know, be able to answer our questions and not just blow them off. I would like to, in addition to your guest's comments about that, like to ask about aluminum and aluminum foil, because that is something that has recently made the rounds of concerns among parents. Thank you.
All right. I don't know if we're going to get into aluminum and aluminum foil because we don't have aluminum experts on. But it did seem that there's a role here for the family doctor, for personal physician.
No, very much so. And I'd be interested in Michael's thoughts on this based on his study. But you know, children, their parents overwhelmingly name their child's doctor as their most trusted source of vaccine information. And those pediatricians have a relationship of trust and a regular process of visits that's much easier to scale, I think, than you know, we can't send doctors door to door, but we are sending our kids to pediatricians, and those pediatricians can be effective advocates for vaccination. I think sometimes they're too deferential to parents. They're not conveying the weight of the scientific evidence in favor of vaccination as strongly as they should be.
Do you think just talking about it, do you think that we're that people are discussing it and hearing it now adds to the conversation? Michael.
I think it does, and I think that it's an interesting sort of question to think about, and I think in terms of the discrepancy between the scientific community and the public, this is sort of an example of how public opinion, I think, is going to be a lagging indicator, right, of the state of scientific evidence, because it takes a while for, you know, the science to percolate into the mainstream sort of culture. One of those reasons is because, and it's structural, is that a lot of science in peer-reviewed journals is restricted access and not available, you know, to the public at large. So it takes, you know, someone, as Brendan mentioned, with source credibility that, you know, the family, you know, trusts, and having that interpersonal conversation for it to really change minds.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Michael LaCour and Brendan Ayan. Let me go to the phones because we have an interesting call from, got the wrong one on that. Let's go to Washington, to Mike in Washington. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. There seems to be a widespread supposition that anybody that's opposed to genetically modified foods is anti-science. But I'm personally very pro-science, and I'm very strongly against genetically modified foods because I simply don't trust the science and the so-called evidence-based scientists that's often spoken of as defense of these modified foods. So the science has done largely by corporations in-house. There's a lack of independent science that's associated with these studies. There's a trashing of scientists who come out with inconvenient truths. Dr. Tyrone Hayes wrote about this extensively in, I think it was the February edition of the New Yorker.
Let me ask you, are you then like Chantal, that there's really nothing that will change your mind about GMOs?
I've looked at this very extensively. I'm a journalist, and I've had problems getting articles that run contrary to the narrative published. They've been censored, and there are so
Let me ask you one more time. Is there nothing that you could study as a journalist, any amount of information, any kind of research in any form that would change your mind?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I haven't seen anything that will change my mind so far. Sure, present it. And I haven't seen it coming from credible sources.
Okay. Brendan?
Well, I have to say, it's challenging to change people's minds with evidence. I mean, what the caller was saying is almost strikingly parallel to the call we heard earlier in terms of the demands for this independent evidence that's the evidence that they'll believe, but they're not willing to believe the evidence that's currently in front of them. You know, in my research, we've often tested giving people corrective information about cases like this, including about vaccines and their safety. And we find that people approach information like that with a point of view, and it can shape how they respond to it. So when we told parents that vaccines don't cause autism, which is a common myth, it actually made the parents with the least favorable attitudes towards vaccines less likely to say they would vaccinate a future child rather than more. So I think we should be skeptical about the assumption that it's just we need the right study to give people, and then it'll change their minds.
Michael, you said that people don't like to be talked down to. How do we avoid coming across that way in communicating science?
I think it's really important. And to the sort of larger question of changing minds, just to put in context, a recent meta-analysis of over 900 studies of persuasive influence failed to identify a single persuasive communication effect that lasted more than a couple of days. And this is for a few reasons. First is that voters don't change their minds very often. When they do, the change is typically small in magnitude and temporary in duration. And so I think in terms of, you know, the style or presentation of conversations, you know, people like to hear, I think, what catches people's attention and what opens the door to sort of persuasion, if you will, is people disclosing vulnerable information about themselves and doing it in a face-to-face, interpersonal way. Yeah. I just completed a recent study trying to change voters' minds on abortion. We had women who've had an abortion. Half the time, they disclose they've had the abortion at the door, and half the time, they don't. And the change only lasts and spreads when a woman is disclosing that she's had an abortion.
All right, that's about all the time. I'm sorry I have to interrupt. Michael LaCour, Lee Rainey, thank you for joining us today. We're going to take a break. We come back. How four teenagers and a robot named Stinky beat the brains of geniuses at MIT. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's the kind of true story Hollywood screenwriters live for. In 2004, four teenagers from an impoverished Arizona high school entered an underwater robotics contest. They had no money and even less experience. But the robot they created, dubbed Stinky, went head-to-head with the engineering geniuses at MIT and won. Joshua Davis wrote about the team's success for Wired magazine in 2005. In his reporting, he discovered money and experience weren't the only hurdles that the Falcon Robotics team faced, or even the biggest one. It was, in fact, that the members were not U.S. citizens. Their undocumented status kept them out of colleges and careers in STEM. These were just out of reach for them. Well, this month, the story of Stinky's success hits the big screen in a movie called Spare Parts. All the while, some members of the Falcons robotic team are still struggling for their real-life happy ending. Joining me now to talk about Stinky's win and how U.S. immigration policy might be affecting aspiring engineers first of all, let me bring on Christian Arcega. Joshua Davis is with us now. We're going to try to get Christian on the line as soon as we can. Joshua Davis is the author of Spare Parts for Undocumented Teenagers, One Ugly Robot and Battle for the American Dream. He's also a contributing editor at Wired. He joins us from Miami. Welcome, Joshua.
Hi, Ira.
You visited Carl Hayden High School many times reporting for the story. Give us your impression of the school where these kids were going to school.
Well, when I first got there, it was exactly 10 years ago, January of 2005. And the first thing that struck me was that this is West Phoenix. It's an urban high school. The motto of the school, it's Carl Hayden Community High School, and then just below it, it said, "The Pride's Inside," which to me seemed a little bit off, as if to say there was nothing to be proud of on the outside.
Mm-hmm. And they're 75% below the poverty line.
That's right. 70%, 70 to 80% below the poverty line, a significant population of students who are English as a second language. Mm-hmm. You know, the school was known, if it was known at all, for gang violence.
Huh, but it had not always been that way, right?
You know, back when the school was first formed, West Phoenix was a predominantly white neighborhood. And over time, it shifted. And as it became more Latino, you know, the reputation shifted.
Yeah.
And so at that point in 05, when I first went out there, the reason that news trucks would show up would be to cover brawls or fights.
Hmm. And so what was the sort of the perfectly good storm that happened that brought all these kids to this one school and the right mix of teachers to get this project underway?
Well, in an effort to try to balance the races at the school, the district decided to try to create programs that would attract white students. And one of the programs they created was a marine science program, and they thought that would appeal to white students. It didn't really. The school continued to become predominantly Latino. But as a result, this marine science program was able to benefit the Latino students.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't initially created for them.
So what made them decide to join in on this program? I mean, there are no oceans around.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the teachers, you know, in an environment where you have a high needs population, I think the instinct is to say, let's focus on rudimentary things. Let's do rudimentary math. Let's do rudimentary language. But the two teachers, Freddie Lajvardi and Alan Cameron, who created this robotics program, decided that the exact opposite was needed. Nobody's going to get excited about rudimentary math. That's not going to challenge you. That's not going to inspire you. And so what these two teachers did was they went and they came up with the craziest thing they could imagine, which was we're going to enter. We're going to create a program and build a robot and enter it into a national underwater robotics competition sponsored by NASA and the U.S. Navy. And this despite the fact, as you point out, that they're in the middle of the desert and they don't even have a swimming pool.
Wow. Let me continue the story with one of the Falcon Robots team members, Christian Arcega. He joins us from Tempe, Arizona. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, happy to be here.
We're recounting how you and your schoolmates got involved in this project. What attracted you to, first of all, starting up on the project? What was the attraction there?
I wanted something, a way to apply, you know, everything I'd learned in school and, you know, also a way to challenge myself more.
Mm-hmm. And how does the mate competition work? What did your robot have to do?
Well, the basic scenario was there's this fictional representation of what an actual underwater robot mission would look like, and your task is to complete these certain objectives underwater, like you have to identify visual objects, also pick up some sound signals, retrieve certain objects and, you know, bring them back to the surface, measure lengths and depths of where the actual mock-up of the submarine is underwater, retrieve some water samples, and do all of this within a 30-minute time constraint.
And you basically, as the name of the movie, Spare Parts, you did this with spare parts?
Yeah, I mean, the premiere... We had some spare parts laying around the school, but yeah, I mean, basically the whole robot was built out of spare parts we borrowed, we got on loan, or that we even were able to purchase at a discount from people.
Mm-hmm. And you went up head to head with these science geniuses, the engineering geniuses at MIT. Did you think you had any chance to win?
No, of course not. I mean, that's pretty much the reason why we went up against the universities instead of the other high schools, because this competition actually had a university class, and then it had an easier mission for the high schools, and we figured, well, we're probably going to lose to the high schools too because it's our first year doing this. We might as well, you know, compete against the university, so if we lose, it doesn't feel quite as humiliating, and, you know, if we happen to beat one school, that's something, you know, you can brag about.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the other members of your team. What were they like, and who were they, and how did you get to know them and get to work with them?
I mean, I met them for the first time basically when we actually started doing this competition. I mean, Oscar and Luis Aranda, they were both seniors, so Lorenzo and I didn't have any classes with them, and we hardly ever saw them outside of the actual robot building because, I mean, none of our schedules lined up. Oscar, you know, this is where he gets told more often. I mean, he wanted to be he wants to be an engineer, and he wanted to go into the military. And Luis was very, very quiet, and, you know, he didn't really speak very often, but, you know, you could always tell that he was paying attention, and he was always very on task. And, you know, Lorenzo, you can talk for hours about Lorenzo. He was, you know, the guy who was goofing off all the time, who was there at the club as a way to escape some of the problems he had in his family, and, you know, he was always getting into trouble. He had a lot of problems just even being able to stay in school because of his grades and some of the problems he got into with other students there.
But as you all joined this project together, you were all able to focus on what you were doing, and your other troubles seemed far behind?
Not really. I mean, no. A lot of these problems are still very apparent even while we had this competition. I mean, we had, originally, I believe there were 7 members on the team, and it ended up only being 4 of us because everybody else either dropped out of the project or was not able to be there for the competition. So, and I mean, Lorenzo was still on semi-academic probation at the end of the school year, and, you know, he had that problem further on as well. And, you know, Oscar and Luis had just graduated high school, so Oscar had a lot of problems trying to get funding to actually go to school because he was undocumented as well. Hmm. And fortunately, back then, Proposition 300 hadn't, you know, come into effect yet, so he was able to do 3 years with the scholarship he had.
And just traveling to the competition was a risk because you were undocumented.
Well, that's always a risk when you're traveling anywhere, really.
What was your concern, that you'd be arrested along the way?
Not mine. I mean, I have family in California, so I visit them pretty often. But, I mean, for most of the guys, they probably never really travel very often to this area.
Joshua, what surprised you the most about writing about and meeting these people?
Well, they approach the problem with an immense amount of ingenuity. I think that in engineering, oftentimes a lot of engineers go to the same schools. There's a preference for kids coming out of top schools, which is great, and we obviously produce the world's best engineers. But there's also a sense of, people take the same classes and they have the same ideas. There's not a lot of completely new, out-of-the-box thinking. And what these four guys from Carl Hayden Community High School did was that they started with a blank slate.
Yeah.
So in one instance, when they got to the competition, their robot started leaking. And this is a problem that a lot of underwater robotics teams have. And it is really a death knell, because if the water gets into the electronics, it's game over.
Right.
And so in this instance, the team kind of opened the brains of the computer and saw that there was water in there. And they had only a short period of time to come up with a solution. They're trying to think, well, we can't fix the broken case, but we could potentially try to soak up the water. And so they had this brainstorming session. What could fit in this very constrained space that's very small, compact, and super absorbent?
And cheap.
And it was Lorenzo who said, how about a tampon? And immediately the other students basically put their fingers on their noses, like, it's not me. And go Lorenzo was basically taken to a grocery store and turned loose to go buy some tampons. Of course, he had no idea
right
what brand or what to buy.
But they MacGyvered. So they MacGyvered. They MacGyvered the solution right there. Let me go to the phone. Christopher in Las Vegas. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I was actually a team member in the 2004 competition on a high school league, and I have to say, we were completely blown away to find out that a high school was competing in the college league. And, you know, the more I hear about the story, especially now that, you know, some of the details are coming out that I didn't find out there at the scene, just, you know, really blown me away at what this team was able to do. And, you know, it's, I think, a very inspiring story.
Well, thanks for the note. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, we hear all these stories. There are butts of stand-up comics about undocumented aliens. They do your lawn, they'll clean your house, you know. We never hear stories about the people who go in the other direction, who are in creative geniuses like this group of high school kids. Do you think there are a lot more? I'm sure there are a lot more kids out there that are like you, Christian, who are just aching for an opportunity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've personally met thousands and thousands of them. It's not as rare as you would expect. It's just that the opportunities are so limited, they generally don't have the option to pursue anything other than being gardeners or, you know, and the next time you see some undocumented person, you know, washing your car or cleaning your lawn, they would probably aiming to be, you know, in school. They would prefer to be studying to be, you know, mm-hmm. an engineer, possibly.
Is there any way to tap into this reservoir of kids who, while they're still undocumented, but get them into a college?
Depends. There's a lot of different communities that approach this problem in different ways. I mean, on a federal level, the issue's kind of dead in the water for the foreseeable future. There's been a lot of opposition, especially in, you know, just in our state in Arizona, where, you know, seems that the state legislature keeps making laws to make it as difficult as possible to get out of that cycle. And, you know, certain states will approach this problem mm-hmm. in a different way. There are other states that see this as an opportunity for them to bring in more, you know, students that actually have that drive to be a productive member of society and that want to be, you know, engineers, or that they want to be scientists, or they want to be businessmen, or they want to do those difficult aspirations that a lot of young people in this country don't really care for anymore.
Mm-hmm. Josh, is the robotics program still going at Carl Hayden?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the triumph of these four guys has inspired an entire generation of students at Carl Hayden. Unfortunately, the experience of these four guys right after the events and in the subsequent 10 years has not been entirely rosy. And of course, the Hollywood film ends 10 years ago, which is part of the reason why I wrote the book.
I understand there are a lot of young women who were interested at Carl Hayden in getting its robot.
Oh, yeah. Usually when we were on the team, it just happened to be a coincidence that it was four guys on the team that year. Our team has always been predominantly pretty much 50-50. Sometimes it'll skew 65, 35 one way or another. But it we have about 10 to 15 graduating seniors in our program every year. Half of those will go into engineering, and half of those will be women going straight into an engineering field. So we have this joke now that if you meet somebody Latina from Arizona in her 20s, ask her what year she graduated from Carl Hayden High School, because odds are that's where she came from.
Christian, you had to drop out of college. Do you intend to go back to school?
When Proposition 300 came into effect, which basically removed all in-state financial aid and assistance to undocumented students in Arizona, such as myself. So my scholarship got revoked, my tuition tripled, and I found myself not really having any good options. This was back in 2006, yeah. 2007, so you can remember all those anti-immigration reform laws in Arizona and all those protests and all of that. So I was right in the middle of that. And since then, I've had a lot of problems trying to get to school. And now I'm doing a crowdfunding project at a college, dream.help, where I want to raise funds to go to college this fall. I still want to be an engineer.
All right. We're going to hope maybe you'll get a little boost here. Thank you very much, Christian, for joining us. Christian Arcega is one of the high school robotics team members that inspired the new movie Spare Parts and Davis's book. Joshua Davis is contributing editor at Wired and the author of Spare Parts, Four Undocumented Teenagers, One Ugly Robot, and Battle for the American Dream. Thank you both for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. And we have an excerpt from Spare Parts on our website at sciencefriday.com/spareparts. And speaking of reading, we're in the final week of our Science Friday book club. We're calling the club to order next Friday to talk about David Grand's The Lost City of Z. And last week, we asked you what you thought of explorer Percy Fawcett and his mad quest to find a long-lost city in the jungle. Michelle in Raleigh says she was inspired by Fawcett's resolve to follow his passion, no matter the consequence.
Fawcett's motivation fascinates me. How do you let that gate slide open? The one that lets you pursue something so dangerous, but critical to your being, that you can't stop yourself.
Yeah, this is a great book. We want to see you next week. Tell us, call us, write us, phone in what you think when the book club reconvenes next Friday. That's about all the time we have for today. If you missed our part of our program and you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join a mailing list. And if you like us, then like us on Facebook, week-long discussion on Twitter, and download our iPhone and Android apps and listen and look on demand. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.